degrees in Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The terrorist attacks of 9/11 brought America to its knees, literally. The nation prayed, and the faithful flocked to churches, synagogues, and mosques, seeking solace and answers. Even the secular has become sacred as lawmakers gather in prayer inside the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building. In this hour, the revival of religion in America and its implications for the separation of church and state. But first, we check in on the latest in the U.S. military campaign. The Pentagon announced yesterday it would stop searching the Tora Bora cave complex for Al-Qaeda suspects. I spoke with National Public Radio national security correspondent Tom Gelton earlier today, and I asked him what's next for American troops.
You know, Tom, I think that question in some ways is premature. In fact, it's the question I've been asking around here for the last couple of weeks. And I think what we've realized over the last week or so is that, in fact, this war is not likely to move away from Afghanistan for a while. So maybe we shouldn't be talking about what next just yet.
Or maybe the what next is right there where we are.
Well, I think a couple of things have become clear. One is that even though the fighting is largely over, with the exception of really one very small, isolated, mountainous, rugged spot in eastern Afghanistan, even though the Taliban government has been overthrown, the fact is that very, very few of the Al-Qaeda leaders have been, one, killed, two, captured, three, surrendered. The network is still alive, if not well, certainly in a position to continue to represent a real threat. So in that case, a major part of the U.S. objective in Afghanistan has not been met. And what we've seen confirmed just in the last few days is that, in fact, a number of these guys have been regrouping in this area along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border and presenting a much more serious threat to the United States and to the local Afghan authorities there than I think people expected a while back.
So these fighters have not just scattered to the winds. They're actually still in concentrations in some locations?
They are, amazingly enough, they are regrouping in some of the very areas that had been targeted by U.S. bombing raids in the past. So 2 weeks ago, we had a lull where like a whole week went by without any U.S. airstrikes.
Right.
Now, in the last week, we've had basically airstrikes every day because they have found that these guys are regrouping in some of these compounds, some of those cave complexes that we'd heard about so much. We'd heard about the Tora Bora caves. Now the focus has shifted to a whole different set of caves to the south of Tora Bora called the Jarwarkili caves. But the lesson is that there's still very much of a problem there from the U.S. military's point of view in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan. Nevertheless, obviously, the war, the focus is going to shift at some point from Afghanistan. And I think there again, the fact that this Al-Qaeda network has not been rooted out means that it will have the capability to reconstitute itself somewhere else. And there is a lot of attention right now to a variety of places where it would make sense for Al-Qaeda to resume activities. You've heard, I'm sure, about Somalia, places like Yemen, also places like the Philippines, some remote islands in Indonesia. There's quite a few places.
What does this mean, then, for the big logistical buildup of U.S. forces in near and around Afghanistan? Will that still be the base of operations? Will they use the head of steam built up logistically and in terms of public support to thrust into other areas, even as they continue the cleanup in Afghanistan, Tom?
I think that's right, Tom, but a couple of points. One, again, I think we were assuming that there would be some kind of drawdown of U.S. forces immediately around Afghanistan, and now that's appearing to be less likely. There's, in fact, a lot of reports of longer-term U.S. military presence, not only in Afghanistan, but in some of the Central Asian countries.
Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, maybe?
Kyrgyzstan, for example, too. So that's one of the things that we're going to see. So another point, though, is that to the extent that the focus of military activity does shift to some of these distant places, it's going to be a very different type of military activity. It's going to be, I've been told by intelligence sources here and senior people here that the military activity we're likely to see in places like Somalia, Yemen, wherever, is going to be far more covert, a far smaller scale. It's going to be going after groups on more of a cell-by-cell basis. So you're not going to see sort of a military buildup in other areas. Now, one significant thing that's happened here in the last week has been the replacement of U.S. Marines in Afghanistan with the 101st Airborne Division. So some of those Marines are now going back aboard the ships from which they operate in the Arabian Sea. And the interesting thing there, the significant thing there, is that that makes them available
and mobile
for operations elsewhere in that region. And I think that's part of what's going on here.
For a while, there was the big question over whether Iraq might be next. We see Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, whose reputation, of course, is as a hawk, indicating to the New York Times that maybe Iraq is not in the gun sights.
Well, I think that Iraq in the long term remains very much in the sights of this administration. I think that people like Paul Wolfowitz and others have said so often in the past that Saddam Hussein can't be separated from the war on terrorism, that at some point they're going to have to deal with that. But I think you're absolutely right. I think that what has happened is this realization that this getting rid of this al-Qaeda operation is going to be a lot more long term than some people might have thought. And al-Qaeda and Iraq, the Saddam Hussein regime, are really two different issues, two different problems. I think they need to be approached. They are being approached separately, discreetly. And so I think that there is a determination that they're going to do one thing at a time. And I think that's what you saw in that interview with Paul Wolfowitz. It's also what I've heard from other people here, that very much the first priority is al-Qaeda. And then once that's taken care of, then we may see a focus shifting to Iraq. But I think what we see now is that that's a lot further down the road than we might have thought a while ago.
And for now, Afghanistan and Afghanistan again.
Yeah, I'm afraid so, yeah.
Tom Gelton is NPR's national security correspondent. In God We Trust, One Nation Under God. These phrases are part of the nation's secular liturgy, but does their meaning deepen since September 11th? The Supreme Court is slated to take up a case about parochial school vouchers. There's a new push for prayer in schools. There's the president's faith-based initiatives. And then there's just a lot more prayer all over, even in the heart of government. Is the separation between church and state narrowing? Have you changed your stance on the issue since 9/11? And what does it mean for this one nation under God? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from Washington is Gail Chadwick, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor and author of the recent article, A Revival of Public Religion on Capitol Hill. Welcome, Gail Chadwick.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And with us tonight in the studio is our guest news analyst, Jyoti Puri, assistant professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College in Boston. Thanks for being with us, Jyoti Puri.
Hello, Tom.
Gail Chadwick, your article really caught our eye. Give us some of the details of this kind of, as you describe it, kind of an explosion of prayer and religious faith-based activity right around Capitol Hill since 9/11.
Well, it really grew out of beginning to notice things after 9/11, especially spontaneous prayers, more people talking about issues of faith, especially after the anthrax attacks, which, although the country may have forgotten about them, are certainly very much in the thought of anyone who works up here.
You still have closed office buildings there.
Absolutely. Half of the Senate has no access to their offices.
So mortality was a notion close at hand, and spirituality as well.
Exactly. And I think what really struck me, though, was especially the meeting that was held early this month, a meeting of reconciliation and prayer in the Rotunda itself. There had been a memorial service on September 12th, but that was more traditional, you know, people getting together and a range of people reading psalms. But this, the day that occurred in December, had a lot more meaning, especially for many conservative Christians who were looking back at the period in the Civil War when President Lincoln called Congress also for a similar day, literally on their knees, to get through as you said in your introduction, one of the darkest hours of the Civil War.
Can you describe this more recent day of prayer?
It's all secondhand because the press and any non-member were kept out of it. But I spoke to several people who were there and also people who watched it very closely. It lasted about 2 hours. People came and went. That's the only thing I would correct about your introduction, that we're not sure how many members were actually there at the end when the Lord's Prayer was stated. We know that about a quarter attended this.
We
but
stand
how many
corrected.
Were there
Thanks,
at the
Gail.
End? It's a minor point, but probably worth making.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the event itself raises a lot of questions about public prayer and whether it's become more acceptable after 9/11. Before covering Congress, I covered schools for a couple of years, mm-hmm. and there is tremendous sensitivity to any appearance of putting forward a view of religion before children that they might feel obligated to accept.
And yet, Gail, as your article points out, there is a tradition of prayer in the U.S. Congress, just for starters. There are chaplains, I think, in both houses of Congress, and we've all seen how speeches, inaugural addresses and State of the Union addresses are very often opened with prayer. So it's not as though religion is a stranger in the halls of Congress. What's different?
That's right. Well, the court, it's interesting, the court looked at this very closely in 1983 when a suit was brought that public funds should not be used for chaplains, that it was a violation of the First Amendment. And the court's reasoning was that this was a tradition that was deeply embedded in the history of legislatures, that it went back to the first Congress, that the first Congress agreed to pay a chaplain to open sessions with prayer, and then 3 days later signed off on the final language for the Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So the court reasoned clearly. They didn't change their mind in 3 days. It must have been part of their acceptable range of interpretation from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So the Supreme Court has said this is part of the long-standing American tradition of, yes, having separation of church and state,
but
at the same time having a kind of handshaking across that divide. I guess it's no shock or surprise to anyone that in the traumatic days of and after September 11th, many people turned to prayer, and including legislators. But I get the sense from your article that you're noticing a trend here that really separates the before and after 9/11 tone and volume and public intensity of that religious activity.
Well, you know what really interested me when I started actually doing some work on this story was that things like "In God We Trust" on our currency weren't always there. You know, sometimes think they're there. They've always been there. It actually was something that President Lincoln did also in the middle of the Civil War, put "In God We Trust" mm-hmm. on a 2-cent penny. It didn't become the motto of the country until the 50s, when in the middle of the Cold War, you know, very life and death combat with communism, again, public leaders in Washington wanted to distinguish themselves from communist regimes. Well, how do you do that? You make one nation under God the motto, or rather "In God We Trust," the motto of the country. So there is, what was interesting to me was there seems to be a correlation between real moments of national crisis and bringing religion much more formally into the fabric of our nation.
So there's an ebb and flow of events, and religion tends to follow it. Jody Puri, what do you see when you look at the rise and fall, and now the rise of public religiosity in the United States?
Tom, I think it's a really interesting observation that Gail is making, and I wonder if we can ask Gail to speak a little more to one of the points that she made in her article that had to do with the conflation of religion and patriotism, and also a sense that given the rise in religion, where does this put secular patriots in an awkward position, and what does this really have to say about patriotism taking on the mantle of religion for its legitimacy?
Gail, we've just got 30 seconds before the break, but in a nutshell, can you be a patriot and non-religious right now on Capitol Hill?
Well, that's a concern that non-believers have had. I mean, Ellen Johnson, who's president of the American Atheists Incorporated, is very concerned. In fact, they've seen their membership increase because people are certainly patriotic, but don't want to feel that they have to subscribe to a set of religious beliefs to express that.
We'll come back and look more closely at that with Gail Chaddock. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. We're looking tonight at the separation of church and state in the USA post-September 11th. Do you see the church-state dividing line moving? Are you glad for the move, or are you uncomfortable? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the separation of church and state in the public life of the United States post 9/11. People have found a lot of comfort and solace in prayer and in religion, but it's also showing up in places where we're not exactly accustomed to seeing it, at least only in times of great conflict. What do you feel about it? Did we need a little God in government, or is this too much? Are you leaning more on God since 9/11? Should the government, too? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Gail Chaddock. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and had a very interesting article about recent prayer meetings right under the Capitol Rotunda, where very large numbers of congressmen are attending. And it's a kind of public display that we haven't seen in some ways specifically since the Civil War. Gail mentioned Reverend Barry Lynn. He's executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And Reverend Barry Lynn joins us now. Welcome, Reverend Lynn.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Gail Chaddock is describing a trend toward greater public displays of religiosity. I guess it's really around the country, and Gail's looking at the U.S. Congress in particular. We can all understand how people are looking for something to hang on to now and finding comfort, perhaps, in religion. But are you concerned, Reverend Barry Lynn, about this the bleeding of religiosity into spaces where we haven't seen it lately?
Well, of course, I'm not at all concerned about the fact that some people are finding a need for a new moral center to their life, whether that's in religion or somewhere else. The only difficulty is that sometimes these days we're seeing the equating of religion with patriotism, and as if they were literally indistinguishable. Mm. And then we're also seeing public officials, not only in Congress, but in small communities around the country and state legislatures, trying to justify the promotion of religion by government based on some alleged need to infuse government religion with religion more now than prior to September 11th.
Can you give us some examples, Barry Lynn?
Well, certainly in the Congress, it was most unusual and I think most inappropriate for the Congress to decide to hold what amounted to a worship service, converting the rotunda of the Capitol, the kind of lobby of the Capitol of all the people, into a place where they would engage in private worship as members of Congress, with the public and the press disinvited to attend. They've also, though, in the last few weeks prior to the holiday season, passed a number of other resolutions suggesting, for example, that schools post the phrase "God Bless America" in all public schools in the country, something which has turned out to be very controversial in many communities. And we're also seeing efforts both at the state and the national level to look for ways to even go so far as to amend the United States Constitution to permit government-promoted prayer to return back to America's public schools. And it seems that the bottom line is, if you can somehow hook an issue, particularly one where there is a church-state involvement, a church-state controversy, to the crisis of 9/11, it justifies, in the minds of some politicians, doing now what, in fact, they would not have thought permissible, and indeed still is not permissible, before the attacks of September the 11th.
Yet, Barry Lynn, the phrase "God Bless America," we've come to almost absolutely expect at the end of nearly every presidential address. Is this really so foreign to American culture today?
Well, it's not foreign to our culture, but I think that from the perspective both of religion and of government, it's a good thing not to have government attach itself to specific religious ideas and to promote them. It tends to, of course, not make all Americans seem the same, but it seems to pick on some Americans with particular and somewhat conventional religious beliefs and give them an added promotion of their faith, in a sense at the expense of the hundreds of other faith traditions and the millions of non-believers that we have in this country. So when government officials just appropriate a phrase like God bless America, that actually does have meaning, religious meaning, as well as political meaning, and try to kind of merge in a less than fully holy alliance the idea of government, government and religion, then I think you start to have serious problems. One lesson I would like to think we learned from 9/11 is that the merger of government and religion is not always healthy. And although I don't mean to compare the Congress to the Taliban, I think I do mean to say that it's a, we should be cautious before we encourage more politicians to think that their primary purpose is to promote religion. It is not. It is up to the clergy of the country, the families of the country, and the faith traditions leaders, not politicians.
Jody Puri, here in the studio, you know the United States from the inside and from the outside. How does this whole conversation look to you?
Tom, I find myself actually concurring with the Reverend. I think he's making some really interesting points. And I think it's that difficult. I mean, it's a difficult set of issues. And how do we negotiate this carefully? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it seems unfair in many ways to hold our political leaders to standards where at a time such as this, at such a, you know, under a crisis where you can't express some of your most visceral feelings. On the other hand, I mean, I'm thinking about having I grew up in Bombay, and I grew up at a time when it was really, I think we strongly believed in the importance of keeping religion and the state apart. And I think for my generation, there was a real commitment to that vision. I'm not saying necessarily that was the reality, but to that vision that this was really going to permit peaceful religious coexistence.
In a diverse culture like India or the United States.
Precisely. So that was seen as a very important part of it. And again, I hasten to say that I think the reality of it was a little bit different from what we had hoped for. But in the 1990s, you see something that had been gradually building up prior to that really come to the forefront, and that political parties that are in power right now really came into power on the ticket, partly as Hindu parties who were really going to promote India as a Hindu state. So, and I think that's really been dangerous.
So in that home country, you've seen Hindu nationalism come to the fore. And now, of course, we're perhaps nearly on the brink of war between the Hindu nation and the Muslim nation, Pakistan, next door. In some ways, doesn't this the U.S. Surge of religiosity, isn't it part of kind of a global trend?
Precisely. And I think that's the thing we really need to try to understand is, you know, what are some of these conditions that exist globally? And I think, again, what that has to do with our socioeconomic structures that seem to be proliferating globally, where you're getting this parallel increase in fundamentalism.
Gail Chadwick in Washington. George W. Bush came into office making no bones about his very intense religious belief. He's a born-again Christian, and he's never put a gloss on that. Do you find that this administration, in addition to the traumatic shock of 9/11, is pushing a more religious tone in the Capitol?
You know, it's interesting, on the way in the elevator up here, they were throwing away piles of papers from about a year ago, including President Clinton's speech after impeachment. And there are lots of references in there to prayer. You remember President Clinton was the one who first started the faith-based programs in the welfare system. So it's not this administration alone, to be sure, but it is an interesting long-range trend, I think, that is trying to redefine the issue. Instead of the state sponsoring religion, the state not endorsing intolerance of religion. The way the president is pushing his own version of faith-based is, we shouldn't discriminate against a faith-based drug program just because it's anchored in a church. It may be more successful than the one that's sponsored by a government welfare agency. Therefore, just don't discriminate against it. I was just looking at the new school prayer amendment that was introduced in the House just before they broke for recess. The way that this is introduced is that this should this amendment should protect religious speech, not impose a government prayer as some of the earlier versions had.
So would it change policy, Gail? Would it bring prayer back to public schools?
In effect, I think it would. I really want to see what the debate about this one looks like. It's hard to tell just from the language what it would do.
Any sense now of the prospects and timing of its potential passage?
Well, it's going to take three-quarters votes. I don't think you'll find that either in the House or the Senate right now. But it has 74 co-sponsors, so it's not trivial.
So it's out there. We're talking about the church-state divide in the United States and how it stands post-9/11. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. A lot of people want to join. Let's go to the phones. Mary's on the line. Welcome, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Jody. It's Mary Wright.
Oh, hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm good. I called initially because you started out down a different path, and now I have two things to say. The first is that I found myself after 9/11 wanting very much to be a part of my Jewish religious community, and finding that when I went to synagogue the day after and subsequently the Friday night after and subsequently the for the high holidays, that it was much less meaningful to me.
What was missing for you, Mary?
Well, it was much less meaningful than the Thursday evening prayer vigil at City Hall Plaza.
Which was non-denominational, non-secular.
It was completely secular. I mean, there were representatives from many faiths, but it was a secular event. And for me, the whole 9/11 experience was a time when I felt American more than Jewish for the first time.
And the comfort and power of that, of the diversity celebration there.
Of the secular celebration.
The secular, diverse population standing and praying, even when it wasn't to a shared God.
Right, and it wasn't even the praying. It was just, it was being there, it was singing gospel songs and you know, some patriotic songs. It was, but it was mostly just being with other Americans, a very diverse group of other Americans.
Yeah, Mary, it's a strong image, and I think like a lot of us, surely, whether we prayed or not after 9/11, must have also felt this, that kind of oneness of the nation and the comfort, actually in the very diversity, religious and otherwise, of that nation, something for strength and for pride. Thanks for sharing that with us, Mary.
Well, I also want to say, though, that the way you framed the show makes me feel marginalized again, just as I was feeling more American.
In what respect, Mary?
Because everyone is turning to prayer. You know, the premise is that everyone is turning to prayer. The Congress is down on its knees. It ought to be. But the same guys who want to take the Afghani women out of the burqas are real eager in just another week and a half to start working on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade and reversing that again.
Well, we're testing the premise tonight, Mary. It's exactly what we're testing. We appreciate your call. Jody Plura, you hear Mary taking comfort here in the very secular celebrations of unity.
And, you know, in many ways, I have to say, I resonate with Mary, and I can, you know, I can think of an example where soon after this, there was an event that was organized in the Boston area, and it was held at Simmons, and it was really a secular place, but where there was presence of spirituality. And it was really a place to mourn and grieve, and to try to come together at a moment of such tremendous crisis. And some people have sort of identified more with this sort of feeling American, and in other ways, it was feeling much more, you know, the sort of wider community in many ways, sort of, which is much more global and international, and in some ways really being part of a very local group. And there was a real sense of comfort in that.
Reverend Barry Lynn, our caller Mary also makes the point that people can feel on the outside, just by the very nature of a conversation about a resurgence of prayer and religiosity, do you see that resurgence nationally, or do you see it represented or coming on stronger in public areas than in private? Where's the balance here?
Well, frankly, what the polling data is starting to show is that Americans who did temporarily start to engage in more conventional religious activity, they went to church more regularly, prayed more frequently, they've pretty much stopped doing that, but somehow they generally still believe that religion probably will, for good or otherwise, will be playing a greater role in American life. But I do think your caller makes an important point here. at the same time that the Congress and other legislative bodies are trying to use religion to allegedly help us get through the time of crisis, they are, in fact, also using religious ideas about reproductive choice, in her example, or even, as we previously talked about, the controversial matter of the so-called faith-based initiative to fund religiously-based social services that have tended to divide people along religious lines in the past, and that will continue to do that. So although they may be talking more and kneeling more, talking more about religion, they are still also using religion as a kind of weapon to badger all Americans, religious and otherwise, into accepting their theological beliefs and dogma and turning that into the law of the country.
Barry Lynn, I have to ask before we lose you, do you see any move to really pull down at least a bit this wall between church and state? I note a recent column by Joseph LaConte at the Heritage Foundation where he points out that the source of this whole language comes not from the Constitution, but from a letter from Thomas Jefferson to a congregation of Connecticut Baptists in 1802, where he talks about the First Amendment building a, quote, wall of separation between church and state. But the writer from the Heritage Foundation says, look, that's not in the Constitution, folks. That's Jefferson's interpretation, and maybe this wall isn't or shouldn't be as high as we've come to think.
Well, I know Joe quite well, and I debate this issue with him a lot, and the truth of the matter is it is in the Constitution. The same battle that is going on now about the proper relationship between church and state went on well over 200 years ago, and the separationist side did prevail. It was the side in which Thomas Jefferson was. It was the James Madison side of the debate, not the Alexander Hamilton side. So we've had this debate, and I think it was properly resolved 200 years ago. And I would hate to think that in an effort to respond to the enormity of the pain and suffering that was caused on the 11th of September by one kind of fundamentalism, that we would start to subvert internally our own commitment as a nation to the principle, not just of religious tolerance, like we'll kind of let people be here even if they're not the majority faith, but a real affirmation that part of the value and greatness of the country is the fact that we do have 2,000 different religions, as well as millions of non-believers who all work together, are all treated equally under the law, and all have the same right to and be expected to have the right to exist and practice and philosophize as much as they want without government taking sides in any of these religious
countries. But Barry Lynn, I got to ask you, and I know we're going to lose you in just half a minute, do you see a real risk of that happening? Is this just an expression of a kind of religiosity that's there and it's been pulled out by a trauma, or do you see a real move afoot to pull down a bit this wall between church and state?
Oh, no, there's a very real move, and notwithstanding that Pat Robertson announced a few weeks ago that he wasn't going to be the head of the Christian Coalition, he is an active advocate for getting religious organizations more deeply involved into the creation of what one of your other guests referred to as a creating political parties that appear to be motivated at least as much by religion as by ideological principles. So I think we do have to worry very much about the fragmentation of the American political system.
Barry Lynn, we got to go. We got the bottom line, though, and we thank you for it. Reverend Barry Lynn is Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Thanks for joining us, Barry Lynn. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about church and state in America. You can join us. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the dividing line between church and state in America post 9/11. Is it moving? Should it be moving? Are you worried that it's moving in the wrong direction? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Gail Shattuck. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and joins us from Washington. She got us started on this whole subject. And also in the studio by Jody Puri from Simmons College, who's sitting in as our guest news analyst tonight. We're also joined right now by Richard Baker. He's the official historian of the United States Senate. Good evening, Mr. Baker.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Richard Baker, you are a historian of the Senate, and you've been in Washington for many years. Do you sense a different religious tone in Washington and on Capitol Hill with this administration and since 9/11?
Well, I certainly since 9/11, There's been, I heard one of your guests referred to a heightened religiosity, and there's no doubt about it. That's there.
How's it expressing itself?
Well, it's expressing it in open ways, the prayer services, the members getting together, both in small numbers and in large groups, and in the rotunda on one occasion. And it's there, no question about it.
Are there regular prayer meetings that draw significant numbers of congressmen?
Well, there are prayer breakfasts that have been going on at least since the early 1950s. And President Eisenhower started those, and there's an annual White House prayer breakfast. And then there is within the Senate, and I believe within the House also, smaller, more private, not very obvious gatherings.
So put this current flurry of religious observance in the halls of power there in historical context for us. Does this ebb and flow? Are we at a high, a medium, a low point? How would you put it in historical context?
I'd sign up for the ebb and flow school. I think that there's nothing like a war to bring to heighten these problems. And you go right back to the attack on Washington by the British in 1814, or even going back to the American Revolution, the Civil War, World War II, no question that you see more manifestations, members getting together, the tone of the speeches on the floor of the House and the Senate tend to include more religious references.
And have there been other times when religiosity was really frowned on Capitol Hill?
It's hard to prove the absence of something.
Yeah, I guess so.
But I wouldn't say frowned on. It's nobody really spends a lot of time thinking very much about it. But it was in 1955, again, in the Eisenhower presidency, with a Senate chaplain who was also Eisenhower's personal minister, they decided to create a prayer room in the Capitol for the first time in 150 years that the Congress had been meeting there. And so now there is, right off the rotunda, this small room where members can go and meditate or just have some peace and quiet.
Richard Baker, thanks very much for the historical perspective. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for joining us. Richard Baker is official historian of the United States Senate. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
How are you doing tonight?
We're well.
I've been an atheist for about 10 years, and after 9/11, I became even more fervent in my atheism. This event seemed to me to be not necessarily proof that God doesn't exist, but it seemed to typify the kind of thing that would exist in a universe where there was no God.
So it pushed you the other way, Steve. What do you think then when you see public figures who expressing their religious response to 9/11?
Oh, it's very disturbing to me. These people are running our country, and they believe in things that you can't explain. You know, they're using their faith to gain knowledge as opposed to using reason to gain knowledge, and that to me is very disturbing.
Have you expressed this in any public forum, Steve, or is it just a private concern?
I'm expressing it now, and I've expressed it in forums on The Connection and places like that. I seem to be the only one in my family who, speaking of faith-based programs, recognized this World Trade Center attack as a faith-based program.
We take your point. Do you feel more company or more lonely as an atheist since 9/11, Steve?
I've felt more company because I've actually gone out looking for other people that like me.
Steve, thanks very much for your call and your perspective. Jyoti Puri, here it is. We've got, on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, people with strong religious belief and a deep feeling they need to express it now. And then Steve says, wait, we're founded here on reason, and religion has its own in a separate place.
You know, I think I'm struck by what Steve has just said and the fact that I wonder to what extent religion, and especially in the institutionalized forms of it, becomes a way to really channel our search for, more meaning in life or sort of reason in terms of why such an event such as September 11th happened. And I wonder to what extent that sort of becomes the doorstep at which people can more conveniently lay their grief and their sense of hopelessness sometimes. So, I'm hearing very much what Steve is saying, but it seems to me in order to really that part of the problem may be that secularism is also seen as completely devoid of spirituality.
And some kind of moral absence. It's interesting in that respect that the way the government leans, after all, these are leaders, may influence the way the society responds to a problem. Does it go at it with a reasoned investigation, or does it look to a higher power for answers?
Right. And I think here Richard Baker's point about that this might be the increase in religiosity might just be ebbs and flows, I think then raises another very tricky point, and that is that when it is, in fact, surging, mm-hmm. there may be, especially political leaders and given the political structures, there may be certain changes that take place at the time that have really long-term consequences. Mm-hmm. So this is not in that sense, you know, just a short-term thing. It has long-term consequences.
Gail Shattuck, talk to us about what those might be legislatively. We've talked about the prospect of more support for prayer in schools. What other policy changes might come out of a heightened religiosity on Capitol Hill?
I think faith-based is clearly going to come up this spring.
Government support for faith-based organizations involved in social care?
That's right. Right now, their churches can get government funds for doing certain kinds of social activity, but not all. And this would really make it possible for church or faith-based groups to, in effect, compete with other public agencies mm-hmm. for a whole range of services, the argument being that sometimes faith-based groups do things better. They point at things like recidivism with prison programs or drug programs, that when there's an element of faith, sometimes people can stay out of prison longer or off mm-hmm. drugs.
So the prospect for that passage increase, what else might fall out of this?
Well, I'm curious about what will happen with abortion, because there are, you know, some groups who feel that the response, you know, the lack of protection that the country had on September 11th is a punishment of sorts for abortion, which kills more people, you know, in a day than mm-hmm. the towers did, they would argue. Now, I haven't seen it yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if that reemerged in some form. But I would say also to balance this, that the mm-hmm. president signed today an education bill that initially many people wanted to see a strong voucher component in, mm-hmm. And that didn't make it. There was, from the start, especially on the Senate side, a great concern that giving public money directly to go to parochial schools was a bad idea. And so, they did the same thing when the faith-based hit, mm-hmm. when it looked like they'd be discriminating against people on the basis of religion and using federal money to do it.
So there's still a balance there.
So you'll see adjustments, too. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Gail Shattuck, thanks so much for your time and insights tonight. We appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.
Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. And Jody Puri, thanks so much for sitting in as guest news analyst tonight. Jody Puri is Assistant Professor for Sociology and Women's Studies at Simmons College in Boston.
Tom, my pleasure. Thank you.
Good to have you. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. As part of the wide-ranging investigation into terrorist activity within the United States, the U.S. Justice Department has interviewed several thousand men from Middle Eastern and other Islamic countries. The department has said requests for interviews are generally based on national origin, sex, age, and other personal characteristics, and not on suspected knowledge of terrorist activities. Recently, one of those interviewed was Ahmed Ahmed, a 21-year-old Egyptian national who lives in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Ahmed Ahmed also happens to work here at WBUR, where he monitors and translates news from the Arab satellite news network Al Jazeera for our website. He joins me now to give us a window into the Justice Department's interviewing process. Ahmed Ahmed, thanks for chatting with us.
You're welcome.
It must have been a startling day for you. How did the FBI or Justice Department first make contact with you?
Actually, it was around 9 o'clock in the morning. I was sleeping. All of a sudden, I just heard my knock on my door, and I didn't even answer it. And I woke up, and I just came to work, as usual. And after an hour from working, and I found somebody paged me. on the front desk, and I went outside and I found a BUPD officer.
Mm-hmm. Where it's Boston University Police.
He told me that the FBI want to chat with me.
Did he say what it was about, or just to come with him?
He didn't want to say to me. Mm-hmm. And then I asked him regarding what, and I kept asking, and he was like, okay, it's regarding September 11th. Mm-hmm. Then I was so nervous and stuff like that.
Your heart must have been racing.
Yeah.
We should say, Ahmed, you've been in the States for about a year and a half now.
Yeah.
And you're originally from Alexandria, Egypt.
Yeah.
Your father is a professor, or was a professor for many years at George Mason University in Virginia, teaching computer science.
That's true.
All right. So you know something about the U.S. So now you're with the BU police. They take you to see the FBI. Where do they interview you?
They interviewed me at the Boston University police station. Mm-hmm. I found two FBI agents and Boston police department.
So how did the conversation go with the FBI? How did they introduce it? What did they ask?
This is agent from the FBI, and we would like to chat with you for a little while regarding this September 11th.
And did they have general questions, or did they have something specific to ask you about?
Yeah, the first question was that the leading told me, oh, we believe that one of the hijackers stayed at your house the night before the event happened.
So this got very dramatic very quickly.
Yeah, it's just like the first thing that he asked me.
And what did you say?
I was shocked, first of all, and then I was like, no. And that night, specifically, there was like two friends of mine, old friends from high school. Mm-hmm. They were visiting the United States and slept over my house that night because they can't go nowhere because they're supposed to travel, and all the stations were closed and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So did they bring up evidence to say that they had a reason to believe that
this was true?
No, they
didn't bring any evidence. They didn't. It was just a question, and I answered it. And afterwards, they started asking me about who are my friends, mm-hmm. How old were they, where did they live, when did they come, when did they leave.
Mm-hmm. What was their demeanor? Were they friendly? Were they angry? Were they tough?
They were friendly, but it was weird experience for me because there's like thousands of Arabs live in the United States, and it happened to one of them that they chose me to interview me, and just I wasn't expecting that at all.
Right, and with a tough question right off the bat.
Yeah.
As they talked to you, did they appear to be satisfied that in fact you were not the host of the terrorists on the night before the attacks, or could you tell?
At the end, he was like, hopefully you were honest with us, and I told him there was nothing to hide. And I don't know, he told me we might get back to you.
Ahmed, you've been in the States. You were here when 9/11 happened, and you've seen how Americans have responded to this. What's, in your opinion, was this a reasonable interview by the FBI? If you were in the FBI's shoes, would you be doing this kind of investigation? Did it make sense to you, or how did it feel as an Egyptian and a young Arab man to be in the U.S. and be in the middle of this kind of interview?
Well, I understand them, the question of me, but I don't see a reason because, you know, like, I was never involved with any Islamic groups or anything. I'm not even that religious, but I'm saying that if they want to question somebody, they like have a background, at least a background to ask him. It has to be something to prove that I was involved in mm-hmm. anything like mm-hmm. that. You know what I mean? They have to have a link or something. They have no idea, like, who I am or, mm-hmm. or what do I do. Mm-hmm.
If you were to go back to Egypt, you know, today, mm-hmm. and talk with your friends there in Alexandria, mm-hmm. and they asked you, after September 11th, how were you treated in the United States? What would you say?
My friends, if they asked me if have you ever, like, if anything happened bad to you mm-hmm. after the September 11th, I would say no. But I've seen other people get hurt afterwards. And
In the investigation or just in general?
No, in general, like from civilians and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
People who were angry or people who expressed anger.
In my case, I haven't had any experience. Like, nobody mm-hmm. have harassed me or just did anything with me. Except the FBI question.
as a young Egyptian man, then, do you think that the U.S. is generally responding in a reasonable way to September 11th?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I think they are like responding in the way it's supposed to be.
Ahmed lives in Chelsea, Massachusetts, and works here at WBUR. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston. This is